Hi, everybody. Michael Britt here, and it is episode 84 of the Psych Files, in which we're going to begin to take a look at how to make learning fun again. We're going to begin that with a conversation with Dr. Eugene Geist. I interviewed Dr. Geist a while back for an episode concerning math anxiety. And at that time, we talked a little bit about constructivism, which has always been a topic of interest to me, and a topic of interest to Dr. Geist as well. And so I asked him to come back sometime and talk to me about constructivism. He said he would. And so we had a nice, good, long conversation. I wanted to break this conversation up a bit because I think that broadly, it's more than about constructivism. It's about making learning as fascinating and fun and interesting as we all remember it when we were younger. I did a very brief search on Google regarding education. And the typical kinds of quotes you find are of this type. Education is one of the chief obstacles to intelligence and freedom of thought. That's Bertrand Russell. Another quote from Henry Brooks Adams. The chief wonder of education is that it does not ruin everybody concerned in it, teachers and taught. Here's another one, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Here's another one, Ralph Waldo Emerson. We are shut up in schools and college recitation rooms for 10 or 15 years and come out at last with a belly full of words and do not know a thing. And yet, here's a quote on the person we're going to focus on today, Jean Piaget. He says, "The principal goal of education is to create men who are capable of doing new things, not simply of repeating what other generations have done." How do we get there? How do we get back to making learning exciting? You know, how many times have you been in a classroom where it's just dull? In fact, I remember one of my first semester in college, I was at Fairfield University, and they pretty much hand you your schedule. So they handed me my schedule, and biology was on my schedule for the semester. And of course, one of the first things you do is go around and talk to all the other kids you don't know. And you bond around issues like, hey, what do you think of this teacher? And there's all that talk about, oh man, that person's great, or oh, geez, look out for so-and-so. So all that kind of talk goes on. And sure enough, I got a biology teacher whom everyone said, oh man, forget it. You know, he's terrible. And yeah, he was. He stood up in front of class with his notes. He had them. Sheets of paper in his hand, and he leaned up against the blackboard and put the papers behind him and pretty much just talked and talked, occasionally bringing the papers out in front of him so that he knew where he was going, and then put them behind him and kept talking. And it sticks in my mind because it was just so dull. In fact, when I think about this, the other thing that comes to my mind is this movie that's well known, although been around for a long time, called Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Maybe you remember the scene where the teacher is at the blackboard. That was Ben Stein, as I recall. And he asks the class a question, and no one says anything, of course. And he just says, "Anybody? Anybody?" So I think that pretty much made that actor's career. But why does it stick in our mind? I think because we can all, you know, relate to that kind of learning. And this is not to be a diatribe against lecturing. I've done plenty of it. And in many ways, this podcast is something of a lecture, right? I'm talking, but of course, we're not in a class, so there really isn't an opportunity for back and forth. But there are certainly lots of times when lecturing is the best way to go. But it's not always the most interesting, and so why can't we do things that are more fun? And we can, although they require a little different way of thinking about education. So to get to that discussion, and which I want to get to, about how to make learning fun, the place you have to begin is getting a good handle on Jean Piaget. And so in this 20 or so minute interview with Dr. Eugene Geist, he gives us, I think, one of the clearest explanations for the main ideas that you would learn about Jean Piaget and his stages of cognitive development. And then I'll have a few things to say at the end of the episode, a couple of announcements. So without further ado, let's just go to that. Let's get a nice foundation in Piaget. And then in future episodes, probably the next one or the one after, I'm going to pick up again with Dr. Geist and talk some more about making learning fun. Okay? All right, let's go to the interview.
We are talking to Eugene Geist, and he's the Associate Professor of Early Childhood Education at Ohio University. And today we're going to talk about Piaget and the implications of his theory for the classroom and for raising children in general. So first, Dr. Geist, maybe you just want to tell the audience a little bit about your background.
Well, I have been working with children ever since I graduated with an undergraduate degree, and I think I eventually got to the point where I decided I wanted to learn more about it. After you observe children long enough, you start to have questions about why do they do this, why do they do that. And so I got my graduate degree, or my PhD, at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where I learned a lot about constructivist education and about Jean Piaget. And I now work at Ohio University, and I teach Introduction to Child Development classes. And I'm an early childhood educator, therefore I train teachers and trying to get them to break out of that mold of just presenting information to students the same way we've been doing it for 100 years.
In fact, nearby my house, there is a little red schoolhouse. You know, hard to believe. And in fact, it even says it on the side, little red schoolhouse.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of the things that we might talk about today from maybe 100 years ago were things that were done in the classroom out of necessity. As we developed into larger schools and consolidated schools, we got away from some of the practices. Now, not all the practices. I'm not saying 100 years ago people were teaching constructively, but mixed age groupings and doing things like differentiated instruction. When you've got one schoolhouse, you know, a little red schoolhouse, and you've got one room and one teacher, and you've got kids from first grade through eighth grade in that room, you know, you have to find things to do with different kids. And I think a lot of what Piaget and constructivism and a lot of more progressive educational practices are saying, that's one of the big things we need to do. And many times we've been here, go back to the future and put first and second grade together and teach them that way. So,
yeah, I bet they had to be very creative back in those days.
They did, and I think that our teachers today are also very creative. I talk to a lot of teachers all the time, and I think that many times their frustration is the fact that they feel like they're not allowed to be creative because of all the regulations that they have.
I'll bet. All right, well, for those readers or listeners who are thinking, oh yeah, Piaget, I mean, I remember something about that, or I just learned a little bit about that, they probably learned some of just the basics, maybe memorized some of his stages. Maybe you want to just take us through some of those.
Sure. Most people who know anything about Piaget know about his four stages of cognitive development. But one thing about Piaget is that he had stages for everything. He wrote lots and lots of books, and many people don't read them because they're very hard to read even for professionals, because he was a certified genius. But one of his writings that has become very, very famous is the one where he talked about the four stages of cognitive development. And what we're talking about there is the sensory motor stage, the pre-operational stage, the concrete operational stage, and then the formal operational stage. Piaget's idea when he was writing about these was to show that people change. There's a qualitative change in the way that they think. Behaviorists would say that you learn behaviors, or you learn certain things, and you make a pile, you get more knowledge. But Piaget was saying it's not just learning more stuff. It's not just memorizing more stuff and having access to things that you know, but rather that as we grow and as we develop and as we interact with our environment, the way that we think actually changes. So, for example, with a sensory motor stage, we're talking about infants from 0 to age 2 or so. They learn about the world through their senses and through manipulating objects. Piaget would say that these infants, don't really have a thought process. They don't have symbolic thinking, but rather they think about things by moving them. So if we watch an infant, we see that they pick up a rattle and they put it in their mouth, or they shake it, or they throw it, or they do something like that. And that's the way that they learn about objects. And again, Piaget was saying that that is a very specific way that they think. Their thinking is different from the way it will be in subsequent stages. And so in the sensory motor stage, we see that infants, there are certain things that infants aren't able to do. Piaget called them in many writers after them called them limitations of these stages. So in sensory motor, sometimes we see that infants have trouble with object permanence. They don't understand that things exist even when you can't see them. And, you know, this is a nice test that you could do if you have access to a young baby, is to give them a toy and have them play with it and be happy, and then kind of take it away and cover it up with a napkin or something and see if they move the napkin to get at the toy. It's also why peekaboo becomes very interactive for them, because when you cover up your face, they really think that you might not be there.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing an interesting study, but you probably have as well. It was a video where they placed a baby of this age in front of it was a train track, but there was a box, and then they let the train go down a little hill and pass by the baby, in front of the baby, and the baby, of course, watched it. And then they put a box on the track, and what were they trying to do? Then they let the train go. Oh, they would stop the train in the box. Of course, the child couldn't see that they had stopped the train, to see if the child would look past the box, that it had an expectation that the train would go through and continue on. And it didn't really get that sense until it was a little older.
Right, and that is basically, it's the same concept. It's a more advanced level of the object permanence, what Piaget called the AB error. It's a more advanced version of the object permanence. But yes, it's again, what Piaget would say is that children interact with their environment, and they're not just passive. And I think this is another important thing to remember about Piaget and constructivism, is that children are not passive learners. Many times the model for a behaviorist approach or an empiricist approach is that the person is a passive vessel and they collect knowledge. But Piaget would say that the people are active, and so the child is watching that train go into the hole, and then it didn't come out the same hole. So their brain starts thinking, you know, this is not the way I expected it to happen. And so that is what causes that development, and a stimulating environment is what causes development to take place to the next stage.
You mean, so what they're looking for, which doesn't happen until the child is a little older, is a look on the face of confusion, misunderstanding, or does the child look to see, why isn't the train coming through the tunnel? I don't get that. You know, it doesn't happen until the child's a little bit older. So I see where you're beginning here by saying that Piaget is saying that the child is very active in trying to figure out why things happen or don't happen.
That's correct. And he even had a word for exactly what you just described. He called that confusion disequilibrium. A child has a state of equilibrium where they think they understand everything. And when they're presented with a situation that doesn't fit what they understand, they go into disequilibrium, which means basically that they're confused. And what Piaget said is that in this process, they can do one of two things to get back to equilibrium. They can either assimilate or they can accommodate. Assimilate means that they explain what happened by making it fit into what they already know. My favorite example of this that I give to my students is about a dog. If you have a small child and you're walking along and a child knows what a dog is and they meet another dog on the street, they say, "Oh, look, Daddy, a doggy." And you say, "Yes, that's a doggy." Basically, that's assimilation, because she already knows what a dog is. She sees this dog, and she puts it into what she already knows.
So it's a different-looking dog, you're saying. So say the child has they have a Chihuahua in the house, they see a German Shepherd, and the child extends their understanding of dogs by including that group?
Right. That would be assimilate, because they're saying, okay, it's got four legs, it's got hair, it's got whiskers, it goes, you know, and I'm going to say this is a dog. So it works that time. They assimilate. Now, if the child comes across a cat and they don't know what a cat is, and they say, "Look, Daddy, a doggy," the child has tried to assimilate. Well, now Daddy says, "No, honey, that's not a doggy, that's a kitty cat." Now the child is in disequilibrium, because this is not what they expected. And now the child can either assimilate again, which is say, "No, Daddy, you're wrong, that is a dog," and then just ignore the rest of the information. Or they can say, something new. Now I have dog and cat, and I have to figure out a way to differentiate those. And that would be to accommodate, which would be to accommodate the way that they think. Because now they can't just think of everything with four legs and fur as a dog. They have to think about, okay, does it go woof woof or does it go meow meow?
So do they have to create a new category in their heads?
Yeah, I liken it to, if I'm filing things in a filing cabinet and I come across a piece of paper that doesn't fit what I a category I already have, I've got to make a new file for it. And that's exactly what they're doing. And as children do that, that's an active process. As children do that, their organization of things become more and more and more complex. And I think that's one of the bases for this idea of constructivism, or where we get the word constructivism, because it's not just a collection of little bits of knowledge, but rather there's a building on top of the knowledge that's already there, a refining of the organization.
Interesting, yeah. Okay. So yeah, now construct. The usual definition for construct is to construct something. And you're saying that's what's going on in the more levels, schemas, however we want to think of them, are being constructed by the child actively in their head.
Right. And we're talking about Piaget today, but constructivism also includes Vygotsky. Is oftentimes when we talk about constructivists, we talk about Vygotsky also. There are differences between Piaget and Vygotsky. They both believed in the active construction of knowledge in this basic way that I've just discussed. I mean, they had some very different ideas about how that took place. But they both believe that there was that construction process going on.
Okay, so
the pre-operational stage is the next one at about between age 2 to 6 or so. I think the interesting thing about that one is Piaget would describe it as like a pre-logical stage. Children tend to think intuitively rather than logical. Piaget would rather look at things in terms of what a child could do in those stages. And what we see developing in the pre-operational stage is that children now use symbols. They're symbolic thinkers. They can make one thing stand for another. So they're starting to use words more to describe things. They can talk about the tree that's out in the yard. They can do mentally what before they had to do physically. You know, they can think about that rattle. Instead of throwing the rattle, they can kind of think about that rattle and what it might do. And they can do those types of things.
Is this where I've seen videos where a researcher sits next to a child and there's something in between them, a scene of some kind, and the researcher asks the child, now, what is it that I'm seeing?
Well, a very classic task that Piaget would do, and many times it's done differently, but it's kind of like a mountain. There's usually a mountain, and they're talking about perspective. Because one of the limitations of pre-operational thought is the inability to kind of see another person's perspective. And Piaget called this egocentrism. And again, this is one of those things that are a little different between Vygotsky and Piaget. They disagree on the egocentrism. But Piaget basically said that the children have trouble understanding other people's points of view. They figure the way that they see the world is the way it is. And so with the perspective of saying, you know, look, I'm looking at this and in this way, what do you think I'm seeing? They'll tell you what they're seeing instead of what you're seeing.
And is that at the ages of 2 and 3? By 6, can they begin the process of saying, well, you're probably seeing the other side of the mountain?
Yeah, I think when they start moving into concrete operational stage, which is about 6 or 7, they can start taking on some different perspective taking. Now, there are other researchers that have done a lot of work on perspective taking that have found that there are even more stages that go all the way up through adolescence. Many times, Piaget is misconstrued as saying it's like a switch. Okay, well, you couldn't do it here, and now all of a sudden you can. There are certain levels of ways that children can do things, and sometimes they even go backwards. They might do it one day, and then the next day they might not do it. It's not as clean-cut as that. And I think also, I don't think Piaget really did a whole lot of work on perspective-taking, but other people have, and there is some really good work on that. It's very interesting.
All right, just to make sure we finish up pre-operational, you're saying that children are beginning to think using symbols in their or imagery in their heads to.
Mm-hmm. Right, and probably one of the most interesting things about pre-operational is, the one that most people remember is that they're not thinking logically yet. Their thought is intuitive. They like to have explanations for how things happen, but they don't always have to make sense from an adult standpoint. So, for example, belief in Santa Claus. You know, you could, you know, a child who is 5 years old, they can believe that this jolly large man who wears red cape can fly around the world in a sleigh and come down your chimney and leave presents and eat that many cookies. They don't think about the fact that if he ate that many cookies, he'd get sick, or that he can't come down a chimney because he's big and the chimney's small, or even that you don't even have a chimney. They don't even know that. They just say, well, yeah, of course, it's Santa Claus. He comes down the chimney, he leaves presents. I mean, the presents are here. They must have come from somewhere. So you start to see that, and it's interesting because when you start to see a child move into concrete operations, they like to have more logical explanations for things. And I'm seeing this in my own son because, you know, I know 2 years ago he was really into the Santa Claus thing. And then last year, you know, there was a little bit of hesitation. And this year he was really asking a lot of logical questions and coming up with explanations. So saying things like, well, you know, I know that that's not the real Santa Claus because the real Santa Claus lives at the North Pole and there can't be two Santa Clauses. There was logic there. He had to have a logical explanation for why Santa Claus can't be in all these places.
Yeah, my own son went through that same kind of thing. He's now 9 and started to really dispel the idea last year when it just didn't, when his toys were metal, but all the representations he'd had of these elves were that they were making wooden toys.
Right. And that's the, you know, that's what Piaget was saying. It's not just more knowledge. It's a different way of thinking from pre-operational to this logical thought of where they're analyzing things. They're saying, you know what, this piece of knowledge just doesn't fit. That really can't be. And it's a different way of thinking.
Those conservation tasks, I just wanted to mention those because I'm sure people have seen those. And there's a couple of different ways to do those. The ones I've seen is when you put 5 coins in one line and another 5 coins in another line in front of the child, and they're exactly parallel, and then you spread out one of the lines of coins so there's more space in between them, and then ask the child, does one of these lines have more coins? And they say, yes, the one that's wider has more coins. There are other ways to do this, though. It's water is maybe another classic way to do that.
And actually, these are all different conservation tasks that Piaget came up with. And the reason why he did that was because each one he thought was a little harder than the one before. So, again, I think sometimes when we talk about conservation in textbooks, they talk about conservation in terms of one concept. They say, oh, well, children who are pre-operational are non-conservers. I think the truth of the matter is that, for example, the one that you mentioned, the conservation of number, laying out the chips and spreading it out, that's one of the first ones for them to understand because they can actually count the chips and they can use number to help them to solve the problem. The conservation of volume, where you put the two glasses with water and then you pour one into a taller, skinnier glass, is one that can happen early on because there's some physical attributes. There are some where you have balls of clay and then you make one into a cigar and you say, you know, which one has more clay? And many times the children will say that the cigar has more clay because it's longer, and so they think that it has more. One of the hardest ones that Piaget came up with was the conservation of weight. And what he would do is he'd have two balls of clay and the children would hold them in their hands. And they would say, you know, he would say, does it weigh the same just by feel? And they would say, you know, he would work with it until they said, yeah, that's the same. And then he would say, okay, now watch what I do. And he'd take one of the balls and flatten it into a pancake and then put it back on their hands. And the thing is that if you do that, the ball will actually feel like it weighs more in your hand because it's kind of like the bed of nails. If you lay down on one nail, it really hurts. But if you lay down a whole bunch of them, you can do it. And so it actually feels like the ball weighs more because the pancake is, the pressure is spread out over your whole hand. So that is a really hard perception to overcome. And so it takes a while for children to get that. And what has to happen is that their logic has to be so strong to overcome every sense in their body to say, you know, I know it's, everything is telling me, all my senses are telling me that there's more, but I know there's not because you didn't add anything, you didn't take anything away, you can make it back into a ball and it would feel the same. So I'm going to say that it's the same. The difference between concrete operations and the final stage of formal operations is that an adult formal operational thinker can use a more free-flowing logic, a more propositional logic. I think a lot of times people try to simplify it by saying a concrete operational child can only think using concrete objects and they have to have manipulatives to do things. And I mean, manipulatives help everybody to think about things, I think, but that's not quite the explanation. It really is that concrete operational child can think logically, but they can't always take all of the variables into account at the same time. And they can't really do a whole lot of hypothetical deductive types of things that are very, very abstract. I mean, they can think abstractly, but it's not that, that really, really high-level, higher-level thinking, abstract thinking is very hard for them to do. And Piaget designed tests for these, too, that had to do with categorization and those types of things in there. They're more difficult to show than some of the other ones, and so many people don't know about them as much. But I always try to talk to my students and say, you know, remember when you took the SAT, or they asked you those analytical questions like, Joe wears the size 5 shoe, and Susie wears a size 2 sizes above him, and then they say, you know, what size shoe does Bob wear? That is a question that asks you to coordinate lots of different pieces of knowledge, and it's testing your flexibility. It's testing your hypothetical deductive reasoning, which is basically formal operations. Formal operations, usually they say it comes about in adolescence. You know, there are some adults that probably never really get to really strong formal operational thinking. At least that's the theory now. Piaget's been criticized for the rigidity of the stages, you know, 0 to 2 and 6 and 7. What we know now is that there is some variability in those ages, but generally we see around, you know, around 7 or so, we see a move to concrete operations, and around 12, 13 or so, just depending on the child, we might see them start to move into formal operational thinking. There's some thought that there might be another stage on top of formal operational thinking that some neo-Piagetians are studying. Evidence, to me, isn't quite there yet, but that's possible we might see that in the future.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Dr. Geist. That is a really excellent summary of Piaget's main concepts. Okay. So there we are. And as I say, we'll pick up again and we'll get a little deeper into some more interesting ways or how what we've learned here can inform what we might do to bring back the exploration. Because the other thing I wanted to mention was we so often are upset about students. They spend so much time playing video games. And why don't they spend that time doing their work or learning? And the obvious answer to that is that video games in many ways represent the ideal kind of learning experience. It's exciting. It's fun. There's exploration going on. Now, I know what you're going to say, which is, well, you can't always be that way. Well, you know, I taught statistics for years, so I know that it can't always be, you know, exploring the new worlds. But could it? Is there a different way to teach some of our classes? And, you know, let's think outside the box a bit and think about Piaget's concepts and see how we can marry some of that so that the students are, we know that they're active and they want to be active. How do we use that desire and pull it in? Okay, so, you know, the other thing to mention is, I just want to throw this out there, where if you're taking a class in psychology, you're probably going to come up on your biopsych chapter. Don't forget, on the website, www.thepsychfiles.com, I've got a great PDF there to help you memorize the parts of the brain. I've been up there for a couple of months now, getting lots of great feedback. So if you need to memorize the parts of the brain, the neurons and all that, I've got a nice little PDF up there. I think you'll find very useful. Okay, thanks a lot for listening to this episode, and we will see you next time on The Psych Files. Michael Britt here saying, hey, thanks a lot, and check out the website when you get a chance, www.thepsychfiles.com. Okay, thanks a lot.